Welcome everyone to session 131, Rediscovering Eugene England in the 21st Century. As is important at Sunstone sessions, please turn off your cell phones or noisemakers, and we'll look forward to having an electronic interruption-free session. We're grateful for everyone coming. It's gratifying to know that 9 years after his passing, Eugene England still holds a very precious place in many people's hearts. And it's been my privilege this last 6 months to work very closely with the England family in getting a new website, eugeneengland.org, up and running. What you're seeing here is probably 60% of maybe what we envisioned it will end up being. I'll be going ahead and during my remarks kind of showing you just a few of the features of the website and kind of the areas that we especially think will be growing soon. But we're excited to have it up. We launched it on July 22nd, which would have been Gene's 77th birthday. Let me just quickly, briefly introduce everybody. Nobody wanted anything flowery, but I'll kind of give you the lay of the land of what this session will be. I'm going to start, again, my name's Dan Weatherspoon. I'm going to start and just demonstrate for 5 or 7 minutes the website and just kind of give you a sense of what's there and what's still to come. Following me, we'll hear from Jody Hansen, Gene's daughter, who is going to kind of do a picture tour and some stories about her dad through pictures and things like that that I think you'll enjoy. Following that, we're going to flip our two Charlottes in your program. We're going to go with Charlotte Hansen next. She is Gene's granddaughter. I know many of you heard her paper this morning on Eugene England and academic freedom and sort of the history of his thinking and evolution of his thought on that, and we're grateful to have her. She has been working at the University of Utah Special Collections in preparing the Eugene England papers, which will become available sometime next year. She's going to share some of her experiences there and give you a preview of what you might be able to look for there in the future. Then we have Charlotte England, who many of you all know, obviously, as Gene's wonderful bride. How many years were you married, I guess? 48 years, and I'm sure it would have been going many, many more. She is going to talk about their experience serving a mission together in Samoa, and then how that experience so early in their marriage kind of crystallized into making some decisions that really affected a lot of the rest of their lives and really the direction of this whole family in many ways. And then finally, we're going to close with Rebecca England, who's Eugene England's daughter, who's been the main spearhead person in getting the website project going. She and her husband, Jordan Kimball, is doing that. And she's going to share a reminder of the context of the Eugene England and Bruce R. McConkie exchanges over the idea of God progressing. It was good for me just to remind myself of it. It's a fascinating tale. It's a sad tale in many ways. And one of our hopes with the website is that when you type in Eugene England, it won't just be the first 10 hits, won't be about the England-McConkie letter exchange. We're hoping that our optimization will move us up there so that our website will show up among all those. So it's exciting to hear from Rebecca do the final thing. So Jody and I are going to present from down here because we have some video things to do, and then the rest of everybody will probably speak from up here. What I'm showing you here is not the website itself. This is sort of a locally hosted version with part of the website, so we don't have to worry about getting the internet connection going and things like that. So I'm just going to show you. This is basically the homepage as it now stands. My screen's not really doing justice to the yellows and the gray, so your monitors will probably make it look a little bit nicer than that. But you'll see we have some rotating quotes from Eugene England. I think we have 20 or so that just keep cycling through, a little bit of an introduction. And then down here below, we have a timeline that you can kind of pick on and get some pictures of Eugene. So from that, not very good when I'm not right in front of my screen here. We have a short biography of Eugene England that we, together with several of us, wrote. Within the biography itself, you'll see that there's a few things that have links to read more about, the story of Eugene, Charlotte's
courtship, you click there and things like that. And we have a photo gallery, and this is one of the things that's all of our photos are hosted on the web. So the fact that we're not connected to the web, I can't show you that, but there's like a tour of 70 or so photos that are up there right now with captions and things that will let you know what's going on. The family thought it was important for those who were meeting Gene England for the first time to maybe get a little guidance. He wrote much more than 200 items. And so we selected from the different categories some of the things that might serve as good introductions to people as they wanted to meet Gene for the first time. And certainly he's known as the personal essayist of Mormonism par excellence. And so, for instance, when we wrote a little description about each of these ones that we selected, and then as you click on it, you'll see that we have retypeset everything in what we kind of call our Eugene England Foundation style, with the logo up at the top, always a box at the beginning where it'll either get a little background or a little, you know, tidbit about he wrote this during such and such a time or whatever. And then when we have the original available, you can also click on these originally published things and open it up, and you can see it there, how it appeared in this case, the first issue of Dialogue magazine. So that's a nice feature, especially a lot of times with scholars, they don't like things retyped or something like that. They want to know exactly what page was this quote on, and so that can serve people that way. So where am I, Rory? I can't go backwards here. There it is. Get to it better. I don't think I'll show you anything more there. The archive is the full listing, at least to what we have at this point. We do want to call on you as fans of Gene England. If you can't find something on here that you know he wrote, we're still give us. We basically went off, the main document we used was a 1997 version of Gene's own. Here's my list of everything I've ever written or done, or et cetera. And so we had 4 years of his life that are missing, and then we certainly found some incorrect information, some missing information as we went through it. But as you go to the archive, you can see that it lists all of his books. You'll see here that for his essays at the moment, we currently have live links for almost all of them. We're a little bit less so if you go to articles and chapters, stuff like that. One of my favorite things, and hopefully I won't tear too many of you up here, but we've got Gene's voice here. Where you can listen to some of his, at least right now, the Sunstone talks are up, so let me. Can you hear that at all? So there's right now there's there, and there's more to come, and I know Jody's especially been working on getting some video up. This is kind of a pain when I couldn't get my whole screen on here, right? 1840,
probably. Use the delete key back on, too.
Pardon me?
The delete key off the keyboard. You can set it back on.
Oh, okay. Great. And then one of the issues, one of the things that I think a lot of you like is to read what people have said. And at this point, right now, we're certainly going to add Charlotte's paper from this morning here soon. But when there's essays about Gene, we put them in here. But we have all the contents of all the tribute issues that came out shortly after he died. So you can click, one of my favorites is Levi Peterson's very moving tribute from the funeral. So you could basically get to it that way. So the delete key isn't working for me. So to back up, sorry. I didn't anticipate not having the whole thing filled. I'm only going to do one more section, I think, is all I'm going to do at this moment. And that is, we have a community section. What happens when you click on the community section is anything that's been fed into these will just kind of show up. But if you go over to the side, you'll see that we're trying to get a community news section. So far all we had was announcing the launch of it on his birthday, and then come with us and be here at this session today. If you go to the reflection section, what we're hoping to get here is your reflections, your experiences with Eugene England, and we've basically put here, I didn't mean for mine to show up first. this was something I wrote in the Sunstone issue that you're able to pick up here today, at least a piece of it about it. But these are just different things that we picked that were kind of small. So as you were to click on this reflection by Mark Richards, you'd see it's just a few paragraphs long about what it was like to be in Gene England's ward when he was the bishop. We're also starting... this one, Rory, it isn't working. When we go to the discussion page is... right now I started a discussion that says, what is your favorite Eugene Englund essay and why? And so we're trying to get this discussion there, so it's a chance for you to contribute again. And then as you go here, to contribute your thoughts. Okay, a couple of our things just weren't working well for the little people. Oh, these are my kids. I think I said the site is fully searchable. If you have a keyword or a key phrase within you and you type it into the search feature, it'll show up and it'll kind of give you the probability of which item it's you're mostly like looking for. And so all the stuff that's there, we plan to add more, especially the area that we want to add a lot more into is unpublished writings. So Rebecca especially is working on journal entries, talks, lesson outlines, things like that that Gene worked on over the years that didn't make it. We have all the contents of Gene's computer at the time that he passed it, so we're kind of going through that and we're selecting things that will be there and we'll learn more about what will be in the thing. So I'm going to close, turn the time over to Jody for some pictures.
The day Dad went into the hospital, when they did surgery on his brain tumor, I was talking with one of many people who were calling and expressing concern and sharing experiences about the way Dad had impacted their lives. One man told me he had asked everyone he knew to pray for Dad's recovery, and he said, because the world needs such a man as Eugene Englund. And I did not say out loud what I was thinking. But what I thought at the moment, and I will edit this for the situation, is forget the world. I need my dad. My kids need their grandpa. So since Dad died in August of 2001, I have tried all I can do to gather and preserve anything that could help me and my family remember the impact that Dad had on the world and could have had on us and can have on us. And there are many ways that I have found to do that. If the world benefits, that's great. But it's for me and my kids that I do this. So currently, most of my effort is going into the pictures and the videos. This is a family project. I'm thrilled with the work that my daughter has been doing and the countless hours that have gone into the papers with my siblings and my mom and so many other people. I'm thrilled that Dan is a part of this, and many others have made this website possible. It is a great place to help everyone and anyone who wants to learn about and remember Dad. And I think the greatest legacy is his language. I see people on a regular basis who tell me how reading something or hearing him speak or being in his class have helped them through a difficult time in their life, and especially on their faith journey. And in that way, change the whole course of their life. because of the difference it made at that point. And I would like that to be available to myself and my family. These writings and the words are now more available, so we hope to keep them more and more on the website. So why the pictures? And so far I've scanned well over 8,000 images and have many more thousands to scan and hundreds of hours of video. But only 100 photos will go on the website and maybe only a few hours of video. I am doing this foremost for my kids, my nieces and nephews, my siblings, and for Mom. And I'm sharing some of it here today and on the website so that you can see the side of Dad that can only be shown through pictures. Really, worth more than 1,000 words. There are things about Dad that not even that many words can describe. My husband says that I have horizontal surface illness. Basically, I cannot see a horizontal surface and not place projects, piles, something on it. And it's obviously genetic. I see it as a sign of a creative mind. But on this last day, he was at BYU. And our good friend and amazing photographer, John Snyder, went over and took this picture. It says so much about his work and him as this look of involvement, acceptance, and a commitment, even in the midst of bewilderment. I want my kids to see how much they look like. That he was once a baby who learned step by step, who had to dress up when he probably didn't feel like it. He learned to work on the farm and be a good big brother to a great little sister. He too had to survive all the awkwardness of adolescence. He was someone who fell in love with a woman who could help him become great. And he had the courage, strength, and wisdom to grow more in love through pain, sorrow, and joy, and remember to have fun through it all. He brought his love and commitment to every part of his life. He and Mom started their life together and family while serving on a mission in Samoa and Hawaii. This spiritual and religious life was not separate from his family or academic life, and everyone who knew him was richer because of how he shared it everywhere. He dove into every moment of life, taking part in the experience of each moment. He worked hard. He rested well. He played hard. And he had lots of fun. He could laugh at himself. He was very teachable, and he recognized and appreciated great examples in his life. He had an uncanny knack for being in places right when extraordinary things were happening. And he chose to learn from those experiences and actively make a difference everywhere he could. Instead of trying to be suave, elegant, or sophisticated, he was spontaneous, uncoordinated, and naturally goofy. And you couldn't help but love him for it. He was great at multitasking. He relished the many different individuals of his family. He loves his kids. He cherishes his grandkids. And he loves, cherishes, and adores my mom more than most people can imagine. He taught us by example that you learn to love those you serve Then in the last months of his life, he was an ultimate example of loving those who served him. He graciously and gracefully let us care for him. As I look at this photo of Dad holding me and my sister, I am reminded that eventually we all take care of each other. There are a few videos of Dad teaching and speaking, only one that he arranged to have recorded to give to us so we could know of his teaching philosophy. These will go on the website. I chose a few seconds from other home movies to give you a glimpse of another side of him. He lived life as though it were a glorious game. He played hard and had fun. He loved, honored, and respected all who played with him. Always seemed to be having the time of his life. In this clip, he is playing with his son-in-law, Jordan Kimball. Called me a few months into the school year to tell me that Joseph had told the whole class the entire story of Beowulf. And he even knew the names of all the characters. I told her that, like me, Joseph had heard that story from my father from the age of 2 on. Here is Dad, surrounded by his grandkids, in the storytelling tree. His acceptance speech for the Honorary Life Member Award from Association for Mormon Letters gives a taste of his love for this, his people.
You're high as a everybody to get concussion awards in the last year. It's worked hard and I think successfully to show that the community faithful and true.
I think I know why they made me follow my mom. I think that they might not be able to do it for a while. Thank you. Some of my earliest memories of my grandfather are of him writing. He would have stacks of paper all around him as he was organizing his notes. I also remember him telling us Beowulf and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight as bedtime stories. I remember how soothing his voice was. I remember how the stories would be slightly different every time, and even though we had heard them so many times before, we were so excited to hear them time and time again. It became so much a part of me that we named one of our cats Beowulf growing up. I remember all of us sitting on the trampoline at the cabin one summer, gazing at the stars and seeing the stories come to life in the shapes we saw. We did a few family reunions in California at Pajaro Dunes, which my mom has showed some videos of. Close to the beach, we found this wonderful tree that had branches that would twist and turn. It was very low to the ground and easy to climb. We would all climb into the branches, find a seat, and listen. We called it the storytelling tree. Good literature was part of my childhood, especially since Grandpa Gene was an English professor. Along with teaching American literature and Shakespeare, he was a pioneer in the fields of Mormon literature and studies, asking the hard questions in his writings and helping to build faith. I always planned on taking classes from him when I went to college, to learn literature and the Christian gospel better from his personal teaching style. I was able to go to London when I was 11. Every spring, my grandparents would be in London, and finally, I had the chance to be there with them. The first play that I ever saw was Henry V at the New Globe Theater, with Grandpa. We were groundlings, of course, and it was raining, which also wasn't surprising. All the actors were men, and I remember that the play was very funny in parts. There would be moments where the words that were being said would soak in, and I would be amazed. I remember looking up at his face during the play and seeing how much he loved Shakespeare and wanting to love it myself. When any of the cousins turned 12, Grandpa would teach us how to fly fish. When it was my turn to learn, Grandpa was writing an essay for a book called New Genesis. He decided to write about what he imagined it would be like to take me fly fishing for the first time. I did not know this until after we had gone fishing. It was the winter after he had taken me, and they were having readings from the book at This Is a Place Park. Grandpa started reading his essay called Gooseberry Creek, A Narrative of Hope. It was as if he told the future when he had written it. Grandpa had taught me that perfect cast, closing his hands around mine and guiding me. The one, two, three, four, you gotta remember, emphasize the three. I was so caught up in the story about me learning from him, tears came to my eyes. He wrote at the end of that essay, and I quote, "I want Charlotte to love the earth as she tries to understand how it works, and to love all the people who try to live on the earth and use it for the best ends they can imagine. To be firm in their sacred duty to be a steward of God's world, but patient and humble, as she tries to learn better how to do that and to teach others to be such good stewards, to excite and inform their imaginations. I hope to give her reason to believe and a convincing example that the earth would not be better without people." I realized how well he knew me, better than I knew myself. I saw the power that literature could have, how it could convey such amazing love. I realized the hope that he had in the future and in me. When his graduate had reached the age of 15, Gene would give them copies of his books. In 2000, I received Brother Brigham, his first published book. His purpose in doing so was to help me come to know things for myself. In a letter contained in this book, he wrote the following. "I believe with all my heart that you will be a better and happier person if you develop your own testimony of Jesus Christ and of his restored gospel and church. I ask you to do the things that will most help that happen, staying active in the church, even when it is a bit hard, praying regularly and reading the scriptures, and constantly challenging your mind and spirit with new religious ideas and experiences. You need to be somewhat adventuresome and daring. Go to hear speakers that your parents or others recommend will inform or move you. Speak out yourself with questions and expressions of what you think is right and what you believe, and do lots of good reading." And that, of course, is why I'm giving you this book. Read it carefully and prayerfully. Talk with your folks and me about it, and let it lead you to other reading through the footnotes and through your own curiosity about subjects it discusses. Grandpa Gene died from brain cancer 8 months after I received this letter. At his burial, we all gathered around his casket and placed items in there for him to remember us by. I wrote him a letter, promising him that I would never forget my legacy or my good name, and that I would continue to question as he asked. At that time, I barely began to realize how much I could learn from him. Since then, I've read his books and essays, trying to find him within their pages. I have tried to ask the hard questions and read good books as he suggested. In my searching, I have heard England called many things: supportive friend and colleague, faithful member of the church, great Mormon scholar, loving teacher, fine personal essayist and poet, intellectual, liberal, conservative, questioner, troublemaker, and defender of the faith. But I was not sure who he was to me. When I started college, I was not an English major, but after participating in the London Theatre Study Abroad program with Tim Slover and my Aunt Jane England in 2005, I decided I would try a few English classes. I returned from my mission in December of 2008, and I was going to start into school again in the spring of 2009. I was looking for a job at the University of Utah, and I knew that my family had started bringing up my grandfather's papers to the Marriott Library. So I applied for a job in Special Collections. Through a strange turn of events, with help, I believe, from the other side of the veil, I ended up getting a job in the manuscripts division with religious collections, and I was given the opportunity to organize my grandfather's papers for the library. At the same time, I was starting my honors English thesis for my undergrad, and I had met with Dr. Martha Bradley about my idea of writing on my grandfather. She asked me to write a longer thesis than normal, saying she expected great work from me, and expected it to be a book eventually, too. Working in the library with the papers definitely made writing my thesis much easier, since I was working for hours every single day with his writings. And the experience of working with the papers, it's how I got to know my grandfather, both the good and the bad side. So I'm going to explain some of the things that I found along the way. For instance, when I looked at his grades from when he went to college, it made me feel a lot better about my grades, too. And when I saw his blue books — anybody have nightmares about blue books? He had terrible handwriting, and most of his professors would say so. And they were like, "Please write more legibly for your test next time." I found some really nice poems as well, though. He wrote some really cute ones to you. They were pretty nice. I would find a lot of stuff written on typewriter, so I learned a lot about carbon paper. It's pretty cool stuff. And it makes everything blue, which is annoying. He kept everything. He had notes from every single class he had ever taken, and he kept all of them. So that means I found classes that he took in college and all of his notes from them, and he would use them to teach with. And he would develop those notes into what he used for teaching when he started in the 70s. Another nice thing that he does is he would keep something called Fans and Flunks. Fans and Flunks was a folder where he kept letters that were sent to him. So fans were the ones, of course, that liked him. So he kept the ones he really liked. And then the flunks were the ones that really didn't like him at all. So he'd keep both, because he wanted to make sure he kept both sides of the spectrum there. He would keep anything that someone wrote to him. And he would keep a lot of students' papers as well. And so if you go through his files for teaching, he'll always have it, all of his notes from teaching, and then he'll have grades in there, and he'll also have copies of students' papers that he really liked. So, if you're ever wondering, you can find your class that you took from him and see if he has anything in there on you. He kept random things like jokes and comics and things like that that he'd keep in different folders. Or he'd find something in Life magazine and create a whole new topic about that because he thought it was interesting. He always had a lot on Shakespeare. He has boxes upon boxes on Shakespeare. And another interesting thing is his method of writing. When he would write an essay, he would start on a little piece of paper, usually folded this way, and he'd write on pencil on it. Really bad handwriting, by the way. Very hard to read. And from there, that would be the very back of a folder, and then he would progress up. So the most current version of his essay would always be at the very top. And in those folders, once he'd sent out his essay to people, he would have the critiques that people had sent him in there as well. So if somebody had said, I really don't like this part of it, you should definitely take this out. Or, I like this part, or this is too apologetic, or this is perfect. So we keep that all in the folder with that essay. He was constantly trying to publish, and there are a lot of things that never did get published. And so there's a lot of unpublished work in there, and he's written about a lot of different things. So it's really fun to see box upon box of writings, of these essays that are organized in this way. Seeing all this work together made me realize how much he did, for one, since there are hundreds of boxes. And since he did keep everything, it makes it so that you can understand him a lot better. He didn't keep a journal very often in his life, but I think through his papers we're able to really learn who he was, as I learned. I found out that I could relate to him better by looking through his papers, that he was a human being to me after that, with all of his faults, as well as his strengths. And writing my thesis on him is helping me to continue his legacy. My calling at the institute that I have currently, I'm president of the student association up there, has been a really interesting experience for me also, as I felt his and Lowell Banion's encouragement from the other side of the veil to continue on both of their legacies at the University of Utah. Even though he is gone, Grandpa is still there in many ways for me. As I read his books and study his life, his love is still present. He's not there in person, but I find the answers that I search for in his words. I learn more every day what an influence he was able to have on others around him. Many times, pretty much every day, or usually at symposiums like this, I'm told you are so lucky to have such amazing grandparents and such an amazing heritage, and I agree. Now, more than ever, I realize the legacy that exists, how important it is for me to remember. The storyteller lives on in his writings and in me. I see now more than ever how he is ministering angel to me and others, guiding me in a certain direction. His hand continues to guide mine, helping me to create that perfect cast. The legacy will continue to live on, just as I promised him.
When Dan asked me to do this, and an abbreviation of what I've written for the collection that will go on the website, I don't know how to abbreviate something as much of this, but he's helped me do this, so fortunately we've got a paper here. Many people have asked about how we ended up going on a mission together when we were so young, as missionaries are when they go out. And Levi Peterson, one of our dear friends who could comment on this, he said, he's often remarked anyway, that he's not sure that Gene, because he was comforted for most of the time by the presence of his wife, was properly tested by his mission. I believe Gene and I faced plenty of tests during our time in Samoa, and I've written an extensive essay about our mission that will be published soon on the new website that I think will show something that might pass Levi's bar for proper testing. This collection, I started in trying to, you know, find the best biographer, a person to write Gene's biography. I was talking to Ed Kimball one day, and he said, well, you know, there's only one person that can write it, and that's you. And I said, I wish I could if I was skilled enough to do it, but I'm not. And so I went home, and I just thought, you know, it was just a real dilemma for me. And I thought, I'm going to have people write about Gene with their, you know, from their own experience all over the world where we've been. So we've, over the past 2 years, well, more than that now, I've collected these stories. I've found people from 30 years ago and managed to get their stories. And so this collection will have more than 80 stories in there, from people from Air Force to his academic time, to Stanford, to St. Olaf College, and England. And so it's been a real privilege to read these accounts of people. And some are pretty hilarious. I won't go into most of the experiences here, that the crisis ones, because there's been, but because of the interest in wanting to know how it happened, I'll tell this. At the time that Gene reached mission age, which is around 19 or 20, as you know, very few missionaries were going out because of the Korean War. Young men were being drafted, and restrictions were put on the number of men the church would allow, that they could allow the church to serve missions. Gene was one of the two men selected from his ward to serve. Because we didn't know when Gene's call might come through, we counseled with several key friends about whether or not to get married before he left. One such friend was our teacher and mentor, Mickey Duncan, who taught the Sunday school class in Gene's ward where I'd been also attending. He was a great teacher for a bunch of college kids like us. A young lawyer just starting his practice, he never backed off from any of our many questions about doctrine, racism — he was way ahead of his time — or any other issue we were concerned about. This is 1952-53. He took a personal interest in all of us and gave special attention to Gene and me just after our engagement in September of 53. Mickey was aware of the dilemma we were in concerning our schooling and whether or not to get married before Gene served. When he called us one evening to take a drive with him up Immigration Canyon, he drove about halfway up the canyon and pulled over by an empty field full of wildflowers and grass. It was late September, and the evening was hushed as we walked into the field. We stopped, and Mickey asked us to kneel with him. He talked to God as a friend, telling him our situation, asking for guidance in our behalf. It was a sweet and peaceful experience. I will always remember that moment under the stars. Mickey's influence has always stayed with us, especially later in working with students and members of Gene's branch or ward. Another advisor was our good friend and teacher, Lowell Binion, who had married his wife, Merle, before serving his mission in Germany. She stayed home and taught school before joining him at the end of his mission, where Lowell pursued his doctorate at the University of Strasbourg. We also counseled Elder Kimball of the Quorum of the Twelve, who at the time, after a long visit with him, he advised us to go ahead with our marriage plans. We were young, Gene was 20, and I was just shy of 20. But we trusted in the advice we received from people we respected and, of course, were willing to follow it. We married on December 22nd, 1953, during the University of Utah's Christmas break from between the quarters. This was also a time when General Authorities interviewed prospective missionaries, and I was invited to participate in Jean's interview with Elder LeGrand Richards. I didn't realize it at the time, but apparently I was being interviewed as well. We didn't ask how much time Jean and I would have before he would leave on his mission, and Elder Richards didn't bring it up. He was a delight to be with as he posed questions to both of us. He assured us that everything would work out for the best. We had put our trust in the hands of very good people. Even with the comfort of knowing we did the right thing in marrying first, we can't imagine our surprise when one day in March, the mailman delivered two thick envelopes, one addressed to Jean and the other to me. We had both received a call to serve a mission in Samoa. We were stunned and so happy. This was not a scenario we had played out in our minds and pondered briefly how this could happen. Then as soon as we were over the shock, we quickly went to the university library to look up Samoa and learn all we could about these little dots on the map. And believe me, they were little, out in the middle of the Pacific. We had a lot to do before June, when we would board a train to San Francisco, then travel on the ocean liner Aronce to Fiji, where we would stay with the family for 10 days until the freighter Matua would take us to Samoa. I had never traveled such a distance or to such an exotic land. Jean and I did end up serving as companions for most of our mission, with a stint of a couple of months at a time when we were separated by different assignments, such as Jean was sent up to a little village called Saniatu, which was a favorite village of President David O. McKay, who had dedicated this little village when he had been an apostle in the Quorum. And so they were dressing it up and getting everything ready for the occasion. So Jean was sent with other missionaries there, and I was sent with a sister missionary to another village. And Jean also served out the final few months for a mission after, when we were in Samoa. We were just at the last month of Catherine's due date for, we were sent to Hawaii, and apparently the doctor that I finally got one in Samoa said that we needed to be in a safer place because I wasn't going to make it with this pregnancy nor with the baby. So we were sent to Hawaii, that very last part. And Jean continued on there to serve with D. Arthur Haycock, and was very instrumental in going around the islands and teaching missionaries some of the new mission plan. Our mission was a wonderful, transformative experience. One of the most pivotal ways it changed our future was how it crystallized Jean's decision to become a teacher. One of our mission journal entries, Jean and I shared a mission, one of those thick missionary journals, because we were trying to save money. I wrote on the left side, he wrote on the right side. Just kind of ironic. But in the missionary journal entry, Jean declares this. This is about, probably a month or so into our first little village. We're in the top of a mountain, and we're teaching the children in the school there. And he writes in all capital letters, "This is it," with exclamation points after it. And it was this time that is a very pivotal time for him in his schooling, what he decided to do. He had majored in math. He was majoring in math when we left on our mission. And he has the experience of teaching, and he just falls in love with it. This is it. Teaching is the only thing. Even the first day, I could feel the growing, the molding, the stir of beauty in good, untaught minds. I can make this a creative thing. I love, love, love my students. I have seen them now with wonder-cut faces and shining eyes of recognition or joy of newness. It's the end of the quote. And it may seem a little bit flowery, but it's really true, and that was the experience that we had. As a result of our mission and the experiences teaching English to Samoan children, Jeannie chose to finish his degree in English and philosophy rather than math. That alone, being married to an English literature teacher rather than a mathematician, has led to so many wonderful adventures, especially our involvement in London's study abroad programs that has been such an integral part of our lives and those of our children. Even before I married him, I knew Gene was a creative thinker, yet it was on our mission that I really began to appreciate the depth of his drive to search for better ways to resolve problems that could make a real difference. He was constantly rethinking ways to better reach the children we were teaching at school, trying to motivate them to learn. Gene applied this tenacious approach to our gospel teaching as well. After a couple of months of feeling stifled by the requirement that we stay very close to the prepared missionary discussions, and if any of you were on missions at that time, you might remember that it was kind of a question-answer thing that you gave to your, that you had with your contacts, where you kind of prepared them for an answer that you wanted back from them. And it was very difficult, and one that we just had a hard time with. So, Gene wrote a letter to the missionary department asking if there was another way to teach our context that didn't require them to respond only in the scripted way in the discussions. He wrote, "Wouldn't it be more effective in the long run to let ourselves be guided by the Spirit with our message rather than a memorized text of questions and answers?" Logical question. The answer finally came back. All mail came by boat, so it took a couple of weeks to get anything back and forth, urging us to continue to use the prescribed plan, which we tried to do. But when it became clear to us one night, as we taught a dear sister in Mapusanga, a little village, that she wasn't responding in the prescribed fashion, we changed our approach and listened to her needs, which included a deep longing for her deceased husband. Jean responded to the feelings of her heart by showing her scriptures that reassured her that she would be with him again. She wept as if a weight had been lifted from her. I still recall the three of us sitting cross-legged on the mats in her small folly, which is a house, a thatched roof folly, sharing the joy of her own, of her new knowledge. Jean's suggestion, and I'm sure it was one that came from many other missionaries through the years, that missionary discussions be much more free to follow the Spirit is now the guiding principle behind current teaching approaches. I knew it made a big difference for us and the person being taught when we were more open and not restricted by a memorized script. Gene would continue to challenge boundaries in all his future teaching and writing, constantly seeking better ways to communicate ideas and feelings, and always asking questions that, as she once wrote, challenged students to rethink destructive ideas that they had picked up from the wider culture. We had heard the counsel that Hubie Brown gave to the students at BYU many years after our Samoan experience, quote, that the best antidote to any bad thinking was generally more thinking, end of quote. We might have felt more confident in what we were trying to do, and perhaps it would have erased some of the doubts we experienced at the time. I believe what President Brown said about more thinking was simply instinctive in Gene, and his ability to teach and lead more and more evident as time went on during our mission experience. There were many things, just as a side note, there were many things of the culture of the Samoan people that we had to help them overcome because they had some superstitions about themselves that for some of the children who felt that they were inferior because of their skin color. And so we just worked with them and very patiently guided them to realize that we were all the same under God. Our Samoan experience has also taught us not to shy away from what seemed like daunting projects. One such endeavor during our Stanford years was our participation in saving an old charming Bay Area neighborhood from being demolished so developers could build a Mayo Clinic at the West. This was in Palo Alto. Jean canvassed the neighborhood, sometimes with one of our children. Jody remembers learning about community service and that experience as a child. Then there was the food drive for Poland that started around our dinner table one Sunday afternoon and eventually resulted in major shipments of food, medical supplies, clothes, and personal items to that besieged nation. Years later, we heard from a woman who, as a child, was a recipient of a package of personal items that included a bar of soap. She said she would always remember that day as if it were Christmas. A final inheritance from our Samoan, and telling these things, if Jean never was asking for adulation or praise or anything like that. He just wanted to motivate people and help them recognize that they could really do something about situations that were so difficult for other people. A final inheritance from our Samoan ventures is how in our lives we decided to adopt an open house practice similar to that found in those beautiful islands. In Samoa, the follies are open, so people can come and go with ease. No doors to open, close, or knock on. They're just poles. There are places to visit, eat, and sleep. Following them, it just seemed natural to have our home become a gathering place for dinners, discussions, recitals, and a place to stay when needed. On more than one occasion, an unexpected guest would arrive late at night, and I would move a sleeping child to another space so I could give her friend a bed. The child is half asleep and puzzled by the time I lay her down, her or him down, but it was usually her, down on the couch. But all of our children learned to rise to the occasion most of the time, and many of them continue to practice this in their own homes. I did hear a comment from one of my daughters the other day. She said, yeah, but you know, the price that we pay for this sometimes was that we didn't feel as important as the guests that came to our house. I didn't think I'd ever done that, but as Jean's teammate for nearly 50 years, beginning in Samoa, we, metaphorically speaking, sometimes not, trampled through tangled bushes, skirted around quicksand, climbed over fallen trees, swam rapids, and got scratched and bruised. Some of our experiences were painfully difficult, but I am forever grateful for our incredible journey together and that we never quit trying to find a better way. Thank you.
I just have to say I have amazing parents. I'm very lucky. Can everyone hear me? A little closer. Okay. In late May 1981, my father, Professor Eugene Eaglin, returned to the BYU London Center after spending the previous month directing students traveling on the European continent. Still unsettled by the shocking experience of witnessing the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II's life just days earlier in St. Peter's Square, he found in his stack of mail a 10-page letter from Elder Bruce R. McConkie that began, "This may well be the most important letter you have or will receive." And I have to apologize right now. I cannot do Bruce R. McConkie's voice justice, so... dated February 19, 1981, the letter was McConkie's response to a letter and essay Eaglin had sent him the previous September. Nearly three decades later, McConkie's letter chastising Eaglin is closely associated with these two influential Mormon intellectuals. When Googling either Eugene Eaglin or Bruce R. McConkie, the full text of McConkie's notorious letter appears at or near the top of the list. Historian Claudia Bushman believes that the McConkie-Eaglin disagreement revealed the division between theological conservatives and liberals within the believing camp and, in a larger sense, the tension between authoritarian control versus free expression. On September 13, I'll back up now and give some context to the story. On September 13, 1979, my father was scheduled to speak to BYU honor students. His talk, The Lord's University Addresses the Latter-day Saint Ideal of Continuing Lifelong Education by Reviewing, Among Other Examples, the Mormon Doctrine of Eternal Progression in Knowledge, and invites the audience to respond to Joseph Smith's optimistic view of unlimited human potential, as expressed in his last major sermon, The King Follett Discourse. The evening before the scheduled lecture, my father received a phone call from Joseph F. McConkie, a BYU religion professor. Joseph had read an earlier version of the talk and told Eugene he thought his father, Elder Bruce R. McConkie, would strongly disapprove. After a lengthy discussion, Eugene invited Joseph to take a few minutes at the lecture to summarize what he felt his father's objections might be. At the lecture, Joseph stated that his father, Elder McConkie, and grandfather, Joseph Fielding Smith, taught of a God that is not progressing and whose perfection is absolute. And I quote, "Though I accord a man the privilege of worshiping what he may, there is a line, a boundary, a point at which he and his views are no longer welcome." Joseph concludes, "I do not see the salvation of BYU in the abandonment of absolutes. And with the prophets whose blood flows in my veins, I refuse to worship at the shrine of an ignorant God." As audience members sat stunned at the divisive and superior tone of McConkie's remarks, my father attempted to ease the tension in the crowded room by expressing his appreciation for Joseph's response and acknowledging the educational value for students to hear such an open and honest exchange of ideas. 9 months later, on June 1st, 1980, Elder Bruce R. McConkie delivered a BYU fireside entitled The Seven Deadly Heresies. The first heresy Elder McConkie warned against was the belief that God is progressing in knowledge and is learning new truth. This is false, utterly, totally, and completely. He states that we cannot be saved unless we believe the truth as revealed to and taught by the prophet Joseph Smith, is that God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. McConkie belittles those who, and this is my favorite line from the talk, I was there. McConkie belittles those who think otherwise as having the intellect of an ant and the understanding of a clod of miry clay in a primordial swamp. I think he must have had a wicked sense of humor that we didn't hear enough of, anyway. His talk immediately generated controversy among faculty and students. In Lengthening Your Stride, a biography of the Spencer W. Kimball presidency years, Edward Kimball refers to this incident. Quote, "President Kimball was not doctrinaire, and he felt a need to interfere in doctrinal matters only when he saw strong statements of personal opinion as being divisive. Elder McConkie's talk at BYU on the seven deadly heresies implied he had authority to define heresy. President Kimball responded to the uproar by calling Elder McConkie in to discuss the talk. As a consequence, Elder McConkie revised the talk for publication so as to clarify that he was stating personal views and not official church doctrine. This was not the first or last time that Elder McConkie would be quietly corrected by a church president for causing controversy and division. For generations, Latter-day Saints have cited Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine as an authoritative source of official church doctrine. However, its unauthorized publication in 1958 met with strong disapproval and objections by President David O. McKay, the First Presidency, and the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. At the direction of President McKay, an analysis of the book by two apostles noted its many doctrinal errors, offensive statements, and authoritative tone. Elder McConkie was also privately reprimanded by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve for his problematic publication. However, few students or faculty were aware church prophets and authorities ever disapproved of and required corrections of Elder McConkie's spoken or written words, and many did not distinguish his personal views from official church doctrine. England considered McConkie's recent talk along with other writings and sermons by church leaders and drafted a new paper called The Perfection and Progression of God, Two Spheres of Existence and Two Modes of Discourse. Then on September 1st, 1980, England typed a letter to McConkie on his Underwood typewriter. By sharing his concerns privately with Elder McConkie, my father may have hoped to avoid public controversy and find McConkie more open-minded than many perceived him to be. In his Bruce R. McConkie file, England kept a copy of All Are Alike Under God, an address McConkie gave soon after the 1978 revelation on the priesthood, in which he admits having misinterpreted the scriptures. A quote is, "Forget everything that I and others have said, contrary to the present revelation. We spoke with a limited understanding." My father had personally known, sought counsel, and received support from a number of general authorities whom he held in high regard. My parents especially had good associations with Hubie Brown, Marion D. Hanks, Spencer W. Kimball, and David B. Haight. Never having personally interacted with Bruce R. McConkie, my father begins his letter by expressing warmth and admiration for the apostle, especially his testimony of Jesus Christ. Quote, "I was especially moved by your witness and psalm of praise in last April conference." He then continues, I have written to ask for a very special favor, one that I know would normally be presumptuous to ask of an apostle, but which may be acceptable to you because of some special circumstances." And he refers back to the interaction with his son, Joseph McConkie. "After last fall's lecture, I got a copy of your son's response, studied it carefully, and decided that his strong feeling that I was out of harmony required that I rethink the whole matter. So I have, this past year, carefully and prayerfully gone back over all the pertinent sources I could find and have written the enclosed paper about my findings. But I recognize that I could certainly be wrong. I accept the authority of the living prophets and not only want to be, but assume I am fully in harmony with them, including, of course, with you. If not, I want to be put right." The letter goes on. It's a much longer letter than that. In February 1981, England was in London when Elder McConkie finally wrote a response. Before England had received this letter or even knew of its existence, copies were already circulating on the BYU Provo campus. If any of you have read it, it's by itself, it stands alone as quite sensational. After stating, beginning the letter, "This may well be the most important letter you have or will receive," McConkie says he does not participate in discussions of controversial subjects, but had eventually decided to respond partly out of respect for Eugene's parents. Long passages of the letter consist of quotes from McConkie's own speeches, explicating his complete opposition to the idea of a God who progresses and his fear that such a concept could lead to questions that undermine faith. He asks, "Will he one day learn something that will destroy the plan of salvation and turn man and the universe into uncreated nothingness?" McConkie makes several statements about Brigham Young that would eventually catch the attention of anti-Mormon groups who regularly quote the letter. McConkie believes that while Brigham Young was a prophet, he did not always speak as a prophet and sometimes expressed views that were out of harmony with the gospel and erred in some of his statements on the nature and kind of being that God is. "What he did is not a pattern for any of us. This is all McConkie's wording. "What he did is not a pattern for any of us. If we choose to believe and teach the false portions of his doctrines, we are making an election that will damn us." After directing England to cease speaking on the subject of the progression of God or share copies of his paper with the quotations it contains, McConkie emphatically states, "It is my province to teach to the church what the doctrine is. It is your province to echo what I say or to remain silent." McConkie expects that if England is receptive and pliable, he will get the message. He follows a prayer for his well-being and an invitation to visit in his office with an insult. "Perhaps I should tell you that what one of the very astute and alert general authorities, I've tried to guess who this is, said to me when I chanced to mention to him the subject of your letter to me. He said, "Oh dear, haven't we rescued him enough times already?" McConkie warns England that his soul's salvation depends on accepting the Apostles' counsel. It is not too often in this day that any of us are told plainly and bluntly what ought to be. I am taking the liberty of so speaking to you at this time and become thus a witness against you if you do not take the counsel. Distressed upon realizing that he was seen as a nuisance and potential heretic and that a sensitive private letter had been made public, England soon wrote a letter to clear up misunderstandings and assure McConkie that he wrote sincerely for McConkie's judgment of England's efforts to build faith in his students by harmonizing apparent differences in prophetic statements on the nature of God, and that he would, quote, obey his directions exactly. Upon his return from London, my father became fully engaged in other activities, founding the charity Food for Poland, developing and teaching the freshman honors curriculum, serving as a bishop, teaching American and Mormon literature, and writing scholarly and personal essays. Most of the family had no idea about the letter, except obviously my mom. On March 2nd, 1982, Elder McConkie again caused ripples on campus and another private correction from President Kimball when McConkie publicly censored popular BYU religion professor George Pace's views on developing a personal relationship with the Savior. In an October 29, 1980 letter to McConkie, England, and I believe this is the last letter my dad wrote to Elder McConkie, England expresses concern about the publication of McConkie's letter by disaffected Mormons Gerald and Sandra Tanner. England reassures McConkie that he has secured the original letter and never released a copy. And it's, as far as I can tell, the only copy that was ever made was after my dad's death of the original. Perhaps you should know that I have learned recently that a copy of your letter was seen here at Brigham Young University just a few days after it was written in early 1981 and long before I received the letter in England. It was understood that the copy had somehow originated in your office. My father also expresses regret that the ripples of controversy surrounding their exchange of letters over what I have consistently intended and felt was an honest and faithful pursuit of truth and understanding. It is still not entirely clear what lessons I have learned, but I am sincerely trying. May the Lord continue to bless you in your powerful work as a special witness of Christ. As promised, my father did not write or speak on the Mormon theological tradition of a perfect and progressing God. In 1989, 4 years after Bruce R. McConkie's death, my father no longer felt bound to follow McConkie's counsel and published Perfection and Progression, Two Complementary Ways to Talk About God in BYU Studies. McConkie had succeeded in altering my father's actions for a time, but not in changing his mind. My father further develops his understanding of the nature of God in one of his finest essays, The Weeping God of Mormonism, published after his death in 2001. If there is a heaven, and I believe there is, I envision my father, persistent and eternally optimistic, having in his, I don't know how he would have done it, but I am sure that he's found a way to befriend Bruce R. McConkie. Possibly he's converted him to the fine art of fly fishing, if not to his views on the nature of God. By now they might consider their decades-old disagreement on Mormon theology to be water under the bridge.
So I was just checking my phone here. 15 minutes. Please come up to the microphone if you can are interested.
I have a question particularly of Charlotte Jr. because you've gone through his papers so closely and carefully, and anybody else who wants to respond, but it, as I read his public writing, and he's one of the half dozen influential figures in my faith, even though I never knew him personally. But as you read it, it seems so mature and consistent, and I don't see a lot of evolution and change and development of his gospel thinking, from a basic point of view. Could you articulate any changes or evolution or development that you sense, or perhaps Charlotte might be able to respond? Charlotte Senior.
One thing that I've noticed as I went through his essays and his writings is he has a lot of the same thoughts that go through it, which I also looked at in my thesis, but he becomes, I don't know, his wording changes a little bit, though. Like, for instance, in the 60s when he was writing In Dialogue, like, The Possibility of Dialogue, his first editorial in there, he says men everywhere. So then he changes to people and things like that. So he does that kind of a thing. He becomes a lot more open to feminist issues as well, especially in the 70s, and helped to make sure there was the pink issue of Dialogue in the 70s, which probably a lot of you have heard about. So he would... A lot of the same basic doctrinal things were the same that he would talk about, but just the way that he would do it, or even opening up his mind to different perspectives on that. And so, for me, it becomes interesting wondering what he would write about now, and with different issues and different rights, with gender, with race, with so many different things about where he would be, and I think he would be thinking over things again. He wouldn't say, well, I've said this all the time, so this is what I'm going to say now. It would be, well, let me look at this differently. And so that's the one thing I've noticed in his writings, is he seems open. He never seems like it's like, well, I've just decided this is how it is, and that's how I'm always going to write about it. It was the idea that he would continue to question and open himself up to that. So, I mean, it's very slight, though, because it's still very basic, and that doctrine's a lot the same, being open to those things. But you can kind of see it if you watch it carefully, with even just the slight wording of how he would look at things. So that's one thing that I've noticed as I've gone through. Anybody else?
Well, I think one of the things that Gene did was that prompted his writings was responding to situations. There was always something. There's always something out there that needs to be written about, talked about, discussed, and so when these events came up, he would write or do something with it. It was after his experience when the Pope was shot, he just wanted to do something for Poland, and so that the Food for Poland thing went on. And when there were issues about the war, and he was writing about that, and when there was a young boy who wanted to be a conscientious objector at Stanford, this was during the Vietnam War, and he went to Gene to ask for some help to write the right kind of letter, and so he was always, you know, he was just open to a better way of resolving something and try to do it in a peaceful way. Of course, he got in a lot of trouble because of it, too.
Hi. My question's kind of interesting. I read a lot of Eugene England's works when I was younger. And it might seem kind of presumptuous to say that some of where Sterling McMurrin was asked, or is part of a Sunstone panel, he said, you know who I would have had as an apostle? I would have had Duff Hanks as an apostle. I would have had Lowell Bennett as an apostle. But they don't ask me, you know, who should be an apostle. I think Eugene England should have been an apostle, for the effect that he's had on my life and for people that I know and care about. He was at a Sunstone panel, the first Sunstone I ever went to, on future directions in Mormon theology. And it was the first time I'd ever met him. I was a student at BYU. And then that was right before he left BYU. And he's the most kind, gracious person I had met to that point within Mormon studies. My question, given that background, is I've always been interested in how he was treated in his own ward life. I find it fascinating to imagine someone of his eloquence sitting in a gospel doctrine class. I mean, how did he handle this kind of thing? I mean, obviously he wasn't on the general authority track, but yet someone with that much passion and conviction and dedication to the institution, with very strong, well-developed opinions and compassion that he had, how did he manage that on the local level where life is lived? Does that make sense?
Well, one of his favorite jobs in the church was the gospel doctrine teacher. And somebody did complain about him one time. Because which was interesting because there were two gospel doctrine classes. You can always go to the other one, do the home one. But the people that stayed in that class loved it. And he also had a personal history class that he taught in the ward. And those things that people still bring up, you know, I would never have written the story of my life for my children had I not been in that class. So he wasn't clamoring for any position. He certainly wasn't, you know, going the route of trying to be a general authority. And he would never have written what he did, and we wouldn't have that piece of material now if he had been. Because there are way too many restrictions on them, Gene would have been bursting at the seams.
One of the wards that we were in, Dad was the gospel doctrine teacher, and then he was called into the bishopric, and there were several people who did not want to sustain him into the bishopric if they thought it meant he would no longer be teaching gospel doctrine. After they let the state presidency know that, they had him do both. But something that gives you a glimpse of how the ward he was in when he died. I went to church with Mom the Sunday after he died, and he had the calling of gospel doctrine teacher. And in the sacrament meeting there, the bishopric member announced that Dad had passed on and that there would be a memorial service. And then he said, we would like to release Eugene England from teaching gospel doctrine in this ward. We will not be releasing him from teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so there was a recognition of what he did and how it would go.
All of us humans wrestle with parts of ourselves, the blend of passion and rationality is one of those battlegrounds. And for one who did not know Gene well enough to answer this question, I would like to hear your take on his own makeup. What was he primarily driven as a scholar, a researcher, a person of the mind, or as a performer who was driven primarily by passion? And I'm especially interested to know how that worked in your family.
The answer to that is yes. He didn't fit into one of those boxes, but he was one of those things at different times. And I mean, we all, as children, I think we complain, as children do. But I do want to say, I grew up, I had no idea and was confused to find out that my dad was seen in a controversial, as seen as controversial, you know, when by the time I was at BYU. It was rare that my dad was sitting with us on the bench because he was either in the bishopric or branch president or so forth. And we had scripture study at 6 a.m. in the morning, and he was a very complex person, but he was all of those things. And he was a performer sometimes. He was, you know, I think all of those things, but each of us had a different experience of who my dad was.
Others want to do it?
Did that answer your question?
Did that answer it?
Well, I'll tell you, from my immersion in his writings, just these last 6 months collecting things and retypesetting and whatnot, clearly he was driven by these foundational experiences when he was little to know that God is alive, and he's had powerful experiences as a young boy within church. And so I think what drove him always was just this foundational, it's kind of like Martin Luther King at the kitchen table. Supposedly, whatever that experience was, it was enough to center him and to say, I'm called to this. I've got the courage. I've got the whatever it is. God has told me that I can do whatever work I'm called to do. So I'd say that, and then I would say, fundamentally, his whole theology is based upon a clear commitment that this life is a school of love. And every one of his essays from Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, because it forces us to, you know, interact with people that we don't want to have challenge us, to his stuff on why plural marriage is not a guaranteed thing in heaven, because you have to have that intense one-on-one relationship in order to have the full mirror that only your spouse can give you to knock off all those rough edges. I just think that's how he... Those fundamental experiences, and then that fundamental truth that life is to learn love. I would say that's what drove him, at least from my observation.
Well, I just might add to that. Where his essays and his thoughts would come out of these experiences. I remember the one on polygamy came out from a discussion that we had with some people after one of the symposiums or something back in Washington, D.C. Several of the men were, you know, really saying, you know, polygamy's great, and I'm wrong. I said, what if this, you know, what if, I mean, it couldn't be, but what if this was reversed, and you were one of many husbands to one wife? And they said, well, of course not, that wouldn't work. And I said, you're right, it wouldn't work. And so Gina and I talked about that a lot later on, because I think they, you know, many times people go through life with assuming that, and then the more we talked, the more, and he started searching for some real solid things to answer that, and that's how that essay came about. But in response to the one thing that was that I recognized earlier, because the children are too small to realize this, but when a person becomes well known and sought after, or, you know, such as Gene was, there were two things. I could see that it would be really easy for a person to be puffed up about something like this, and I said, you know, I don't want to live with somebody who's got a puffed up head. And he took that to heart. And there were times that we talked about a lot of stuff that went after he had given a talk or something. And we kind of talked about the things that really did work. This started in Samoa. We were teaching in the same little building that was, you know, maybe as long as this room is wide, and his class was at one end, mine was at the other. So we were aware of how our teaching skills were going, or non-skills were going. And so we talked about what really worked. And so this became a pattern through our lives, and same with his essays. One of the struggles that you have, I think, with somebody who, when you're married to somebody that well-known, or children of that person, is that a lot of people feel that they own a piece of Gene or that person, and assume that they can, you know, take that on. And so sometimes when he was in demand by people who didn't know where the line was, and would impose and beyond what was, I mean, Jean was giving, and we, and you know, having a home and everything, we always tried to include the person that he might be working with or counseling with together with me, and joining with our family at times, to give that person a clear message that we were there to help, and but that it wasn't an exclusive sort of thing. So there's, you know, that just goes with, that goes with the territory, and it's kind of tough sometimes.
Kim, I'm sorry. Me starting kind of took away your time, and I'm glad for the last little bit. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I hope you enjoyed the session. I hope you will visit the site often. There's a chance to sign up on the site for the RSS feed so you can learn about changes. We've created a Facebook page, Eugene England Foundation page, so if you have a Facebook account and want to sign up there, we'll periodically announce when new features go up, or really, you know, kind of, we won't be pestering you all the time, but we'll certainly make announcements there. We're going to start a Twitter feed and things like that. So we hope you'll engage. We hope you'll make suggestions for the website. We hope that you will rediscover Eugene England for yourself, for future generations. We hope this will help. So thankful. Thanks for coming. There's more of these. I have a whole half more cases if anybody wanted to send us an issue. So thank you.